Right now, somewhere in the world, an AI agent is reading a code base. It's spotting a bug, rewriting the file, running a test, and, pushing the fix straight to production.
All without a single human being anywhere near the keyboard.
Exactly. And I mean, it looks like magic, right? It looks like there's this ghost in the machine that somehow just inherently understands what to do. Like, it has its own free will.
Yeah, that's the illusion. And it is a very convincing illusion.
But today, in this audio class, we are going to completely tear that machine apart. We're going to put that ghost on the operating table, expose the exact, nuts and bolts of its anatomy, and show you exactly how that illusion of autonomy is engineered.
We are stripping away the magic completely, because when you watch these systems operate, it's incredibly easy to fall into the trap of anthropomorphizing them.
Right, like assuming they actually know what they're doing.
Assuming they have a conscious understanding, yeah. But the reality is actually far more fascinating because it is purely mechanical. I mean, we are basically looking at a beautifully arranged set of deterministic pipes, loops, and rules.
Just wrapped around a text prediction engine.
Exactly.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We have a very specific mission for you in this session. Our syllabus today is based on a literal masterclass from Dr. Neil Agarwal, broadcast from Nairobi, Kenya, dated July 10th, 2026.
It's a brilliant breakdown.
It really is. And, most of us already know the basic metal of neural networks, right? Like, we understand the fundamental concept that large language models, or LLMs, are essentially just highly advanced autocomplete
All
engines.
right, they predict the next word in a sequence based on probability. That's it.
But an autocomplete engine cannot open your terminal and run a command. It can't verify its own work. So we're traveling up the stack today to answer one massive question.
What exactly are the six core organs wrapped around that language model to turn it into an autonomous agent?
Yes. And by the time we finish dissecting these six organs, any agent you encounter in the wild, whether it's some open source coding assistant you downloaded or a massive enterprise-grade automation tool, it will make total sense to you.
You'll be able to literally look at its behavior and visualize exactly which piece of its architecture is firing at that exact millisecond.
It's going to be so cool. But before we bring out the scalpel and look at the first organ, we have to address the philosophical shift here. Dr. Agarwal talks about this in terms of tearing up a 70-year-old contract.
The old contract between human and computer.
Right. We are fundamentally changing how software works. So, what was that old contract?
Well, to understand the old contract, you just have to look at classical software.
Yeah.
The quintessential example Dr. Agarwal uses is the grep command in Unix.
Oh, yeah. Grep. A classic.
Right. Written decades ago to search plain text datasets for lines matching a regular expression. When a software engineer wrote grep, they locked in the sequence of operations forever.
Like it's set in stone.
Exactly. The control float, every single, if this happens, do that, every loop, every branch of logic, it was frozen in time the exact moment the code was compiled.
So the software is effectively a train placed on fixed tracks. The developer laid the steel down. The train can go fast, it can go slow, it can stop at the designated stations, but it can never, like, spontaneously decide to take a left turn into a field just because it saw something interesting out the window.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. I mean, if you give grep a pattern and a file, it searches for the pattern, prints the result, and it exits.
It does its job and stops.
Yeah. It will never read a file, find a typo, and independently decide, oh, the user probably meant to spell this differently. I should open a text editor and fix it. It lacks the capacity to invent a new sequence of actions.
But agentic software just takes that entire paradigm and throws it out the window.
Completely.
It's like an off-road vehicle building its own map as it drives. You give an AI agent a plain English goal, right? Something like add error handling to the login function. And the sequence of operations is not predetermined at all. It is literally invented at runtime.
Right, because the model reads your prompt and it decides the very first step. It might generate text saying, first, I need to list the files in the current directory to find the login function.
It figures out step one on its own.
Yeah, and then it observes the result of that action. Based on that new information, it decides the second step. If it can't find the file, it takes a detour.
What if it finds the file but it doesn't have permissions to open it?
Then it takes a different detour. It continues this cycle of observing and acting until it judges the overarching goal is complete. The specific path it takes to get from your prompt to the final solution will likely never be repeated exactly the same way twice.
Okay, but let's unpack this for a second because I can hear the pushback from anyone who writes code. If the software is just making it up on the fly If it's this off-road vehicle driving without tracks, where is the actual program?
That's the big question.
Right, because software needs rigid structure to run on a computer's processor. It can't just be pure imagination and text generation. If the model is just predicting words, how does it not just immediately crash into a tree?
And that leads us to the absolute core mechanism of the entire system. The program is a loop.
Just a loop.
Just a loop. It is commonly called the agent loop or the orchestration loop. And here is the crucial reframe you have to grasp. The LLM's output is the control flow.
Wait, explain that. The text itself is the control flow.
Yes. The language model itself never actually does anything. It has no hands. It cannot execute a Python script. It cannot edit your registry. It is simply a stochastic engine, a system based on probabilities generating text.
Okay, so it just talks.
Exactly. The agent loop is the deterministic plumbing wrapped around it. The loop reads the model's text requests, executes those requests on the actual computer, feeds the outcomes back to the model, and essentially asks, okay, what's next?
Okay, let me visualize this to make sure I have the mechanics right. The loop is basically a middleman. I type, fix the bug. The loop hands that to the model. The model calculates probabilities and spits out a string of text that happens to be formatted as a command, like read the login file.
Right.
Then the loop intercepts that text, says, hold on, physically goes and reads the file on my hard drive, takes the text inside that file, hands it back to the model, and says, here is what I found. Now what?
You have just described the exact heartbeat of an autonomous agent. That's it. And there is a specific architectural term for how this loop is designed.
Reentrancy.
Reentrancy. Okay.
Yeah. And when a beginner tries to build an AI agent, they usually make a massive mistake right here.
What do they do? They try to write specific code to handle the results of specific tools. So they'll write an IF statement that says, if the file read is successful, parse the text and look for errors. If the file read fails, tell the user.
Which is exactly how you would write classical software. You try to anticipate every possible outcome and write a specific branch of code for it.
Exactly. But in an agent loop, there are no special branches for handling tool results. The plumbing is completely intentionally dumb.
Dumb plumbing. I love that.
It has to be. When the loop executes a tool, whether it succeeds brilliantly or fails catastrophically with a massive red error stack trace, the loop does exactly one thing.
What does it do?
It takes that result, appends it to the bottom of the running transcript of the conversation, and feeds the entire lengthened transcript right back into the model.
It just dumps the raw reality back into the chat log.
Yes. It defers all the intelligence, all the interpretation of what that error actually means to the language model.
Wow. So there's no custom error handling in the code. It just says, hey, brain, look at this mess. Figure it out.
All of it. There is one single loop with no special cases. This reentrancy is the secret to why agents feel so coherent across, like, a 20-step debugging task. The model is constantly reevaluating the entire history of its actions and their consequences on every single pass.
But wait, if it's a continuous loop of appending results and asking what's next, how does it ever stop? In classical software, you write a while loop and you set a condition, like, while the task is not done, keep running.
Right, a completion flag.
Yeah, when the task hits 100%, a flag is triggered and the program halts. But there is no completion flag here.
That's because termination in agentic architecture is determined by a behavior, not a hard-coded flag.
A behavior.
Yeah. The loop ends simply because the model stops requesting actions. The model looks at the transcript, sees that the login function now has error handling, and instead of generating a tool request, it just generates a regular text reply addressed to the user. I have added the error handling.
Oh. The loop sees that no tools were requested, and that is the natural stop condition.
Precisely. It ends because the brain decides it's done talking to the tools and wants to talk to the human again.
That is so elegant. But wait, I'm thinking about edge cases here. What if the brain gets confused?
Ah, yeah. In a production environment, you absolutely cannot rely entirely on the model's good judgment.
Right, because models hallucinate.
All the time. A confused model might enter a hallucination loop, endlessly reading the exact same file, forgetting what it read, and reading it again. And because you are paying a fraction of a cent for every token generated, an infinite loop will drain your API budget overnight.
You'd wake up to a massive bill because your agent spent 8 hours reading a CSS file.
Exactly. So mature systems implement hard backstops, like a maximum number of turns, a strict token budget, or just a manual user abort button. But architecturally, the elegant natural stop condition is the absence of an action request.
Okay, so we have the heart beating. We understand the agent loop, this relentless cycle of asking the model for instructions, executing them blindly, and appending the results to a transcript. If the loop is the cardiac cycle, let's bring out the rest of the organism.
Let's do it. Dr. Agarwal breaks the agent down into six core building blocks, or organs.
Let's examine the first two, because they define how the agent interacts with the outside world. Organ number one, the interface.
Right. Continuing the medical analogy, the interface is the skin, or the face, of the organism. This is the surface area where you, the human, interact with it.
So like the chat window?
Could be a chat window, yeah. It might be a terminal window where you are typing commands. It might be a slick side pane in your code editor.
Now, I feel like the temptation for a developer building a web chat interface is to make it smart, right? To have the web interface itself parse the text, format the code blocks, maybe even handle some of the simpler tool requests locally just to save time.
And Dr. Agarwal explicitly warns against doing that.
Oh.
Yeah. The secret to a robust agent is keeping the interface layer razor thin. The interface should contain absolutely zero business logic. Its only real job is to capture your keystrokes, feed them into the agent loop, and stream the loop's output back to your screen.
But why the strict separation? Wouldn't a smart UI be faster?
Because you keep the interface thin, the exact same core engine can seamlessly drive any experience. You can unplug the slick graphical code editor plugin and plug in a completely headless script running on a remote server in a data center, and the agent behaves identically.
Oh, I see. It's totally portable.
Exactly. If you start baking agent logic like how to format a file read or how to parse an error into the user interface code, you create a fragile, tightly coupled system. When you want to update how the agent thinks, you suddenly have to rewrite your front-end web code. The face should just be a face.
That makes perfect sense. Keep the brains in the brain. Which brings us to organ number two, the toolbox. If the interface is the face, the toolbox is the motor system.
Hands and feet.
Right. It contains the actual actions the agent is allowed to request. We mentioned reading a file, but a mature coding agent might have a toolbox with like 50 different tools, right? Searching the web, compiling code, running a linter, querying a database, creating a new directory.
Yeah, the toolbox can be massive.
But here's my question. If the agent can use 50 different tools, doesn't that central agent loop we just talked about have to become a massive, tangled mess of logic?
How do you mean?
Well, if the loop has to know how to execute a web search and also know how to compile C++ code and also know how to query a SQL database, the loop itself becomes infinitely complex. It's just a giant wall of IF statements.
And you are describing the exact architectural trap that completely doomed the first generation of AI agents.
Really? That's what people did?
Oh, yeah. Developers built a central dispatcher inside the loop. The loop would literally say, if the tool requested is read file, run this specific Python function. Else if the tool is web search, run this API call.
That sounds like a nightmare to maintain.
It was. As the toolbox grew, that central dispatcher became a massive bottleneck and a source of constant bugs. The crucial design insight that separates a fragile prototype from a production-grade agent is this one rule. Tools must describe themselves.
Tools must describe themselves. Okay, let's break that down. How does a piece of code describe itself to a system?
It means a tool is not just a raw function you execute. It is a self-contained package that carries its own metadata.
Okay, so it has luggage.
Yeah, exactly. When you drop a new tool into the toolbox, it brings along a JSON schema that describes its exact required inputs in plain English so the LLM can actually understand how to use it.
Oh, so the tool tells the LLM, hey, I need a file path and a line number.
Exactly. And it brings a declaration of whether it is safe to run simultaneously with other tools. It brings its own strict permission rules. It even brings its own instructions for how its output should be displayed on the interface.
It's like hiring a highly specialized independent contractor. If you hire a crane operator for a construction site, you, the site manager, do not need to know the hydraulic pressure required to lift a steel beam.
You definitely don't.
Right. You don't need to know how to start the engine. The operator brings their own manual, their own safety protocols, and their own expertise. You just manage the overarching project and say, hey, move that beam.
That is exactly it. And because the tool holds all of its own instructions and metadata, the central agent loop stays entirely generic. You want to add a 51st tool, you just drop the self-describing package into the toolbox folder.
And you don't touch the loop at all.
You touch zero lines of the central orchestration code. When the loop boots up, it simply sweeps the folder, asks the toolbox, hey, what tools do you have today? And passes that aggregated metadata straight to the language model. This decoupling prevents the system from collapsing under its own weight as it gets more capable.
That is incredibly elegant. So we have a face and we have a highly modular motor system, but we hit a physical limit here, don't we?
Which limit?
Well, what happens when a task is simply too vast for one pair of hands? If I ask an agent to refactor a massive, monolithic 10,000 file code base, it cannot load all of that into its active context window at once. It'll just lose its mind.
Oh, absolutely. It will forget what it's doing halfway through.
Right. So how does it manage massive scale? And this brings us to organs 3 and 4, subagents and state. Let's look at subagents first. Dr. Agarwal calls this the referral.
The referral is a vital survival mechanism for the context window. One of the tools inside the toolbox, sitting right next to read file and search web, is a tool simply called spawn subagent.
It can literally build a clone of itself.
Basically, yeah. When a task is too broad, the parent agent can delegate. It might realize, okay, before I can rewrite this authentication module, I need to understand how this archaic, undocumented database library works. Instead of reading 30 files myself, I am going to spawn a subagent. Its only goal is to research the database library and write me a one-page summary.
The genius here is how the memory is isolated, isn't it? The child agent boots up with a completely fresh blank transcript.
A totally clean slate.
Yeah. It goes off, runs its own loop, reads 30 files, makes mistakes, gets error codes, and tries again. And the parent agent doesn't have to read a single word of that messy process.
It doesn't see any of the trial and error.
Right. The parent is shielded from the noise. It only receives the final, polished, one-page summary the child produces.
It is the exact dynamic of an attending physician referring a patient to a specialist. The attending physician does not need to look at the raw data coming off the MRI machine. They don't need to hear the radiologist's internal monologue as they study the scans.
They just want the bottom line.
Exactly. The attending just needs the final synthesized report to make the next overarching decision. This prevents the parent's context window from getting polluted with irrelevant details, so it can stay focused on the primary objective.
But, you know, if I am a developer building this, my instinct is to make the sub-agent a lighter, faster version of the main agent. Maybe a stripped-down loop that doesn't have all the heavy safety checks, just to save compute time.
And Dr. Agarwal says that is a fatal error.
Really? Why?
It is a recipe for catastrophic failure. The design rule is non-negotiable. The subagent must be the exact same orchestration loop as the parent.
The exact same one. No light versions.
No light versions. It might have a smaller, restricted toolbox like. Maybe the child is only allowed to read files, not edit them.
Yeah.
But the loop itself must be identical.
Well, why is that so rigid? I mean, shouldn't we optimize for speed?
Because you want the child to automatically inherit all the safety limits, the error handling, and the permission structures of the main system. If you try to write a mini loop for subagents, you are inevitably going to introduce inconsistencies.
Oh, I see. The child might bypass a security tripwire that the parent would have caught.
Exactly. Or it might encounter an edge case error that literally crashes the script because the mini loop lacks the robust error recovery of the main loop. By using the exact same architecture, the subagent goes through a totally predictable lifecycle. It is queued, it is running, it finishes, it fails, or it gets canceled. The parent can reliably inspect and manage that life cycle at any moment.
That makes total sense. Keep the core engine identical. So the agent is spawning children, it's running loops, it's holding summaries. It needs a place to store all this rapidly moving information, and that is organ number 4, state.
The working memory of the exact moment in time.
Right. And Dr. Agarwal makes a very sharp distinction here that really separates amateur weekend projects from enterprise software. Mature systems physically separate state into 2 distinct buckets. So let's examine bucket A session infrastructure.
Session infrastructure is a foundational data of the current run. This includes the static context, like what is the working directory the agent is currently operating inside? Which specific LLM is powering the brain right now? Is it GPT-4 or maybe a local Llama model? What is the accumulated financial cost of the API calls so far? What's the unique session ID?
This is the desk you are sitting at. It's the physical room you are working in. You set up your desk once when you sit down, and it rarely changes while you work. You don't swap out your desk every 5 seconds.
No, you definitely don't.
And because this data is so static, the system can just use a plain mutable object in the code to store it. It's cheap, it's simple, it doesn't require any complex monitoring. But then we have Bucket B Live UI State, and this is a completely different beast.
Oh, entirely different. Live UI State is the rapidly changing data that dictates what the human is actually seeing on the screen in real time. This is the stream of text being typed out token by token. It's the progress spinner's spinning while a tool executes. It's the pending permission request waiting for the user to click approve. It is hyperactive. It changes dozens of times a second. And because it needs to instantly reflect on the interface, it must live in a reactive store. It has to constantly push updates to the screen.
So if bucket A is the heavy oak desk, bucket B is the frantic scribbling on your notepad as you brainstorm. You are constantly updating it, crossing things out, tearing off pages. The visual feedback is immediate.
That's a great way to put it.
Now, if I'm hacking together my first agent over a weekend, why can't I just throw the desk and the notepad into the same storage container? Why does Dr. Agarwal call mixing these two buckets a classic beginner error? What actually physically breaks in the software if you just dump all your state into one big reactive store?
It creates a massive unnecessary performance bottleneck.
Yeah.
If you make everything reactive, meaning the software framework is constantly neurotically watching every single variable for a change so it can trigger a screen update, you are paying a massive computational overhead on static data.
So it's checking the session ID 50 times a second to see if it changed.
Yes. The system is burning CPU cycles monitoring the starting directory, which will literally never change during the run. The entire application just becomes sluggish and bogs down.
And I imagine the reverse is true, too. If you make nothing reactive just to save CPU cycles, your interface dies.
Exactly. The agent might be furiously working in the background, spawning subagents and reading files, but your screen is totally frozen because the UI isn't being explicitly pushed the new information.
Okay, so by splitting them, you achieve the perfect balance. You get the cheap efficiency of static data for the infrastructure and the instantaneous responsiveness of reactive data for the interface.
It is a hallmark of an architecture that has actually been battle-tested in the real world.
We've covered the short-term state, the desk, and the notepad. But we have a fatal flaw in the system we've built so far. If I close my laptop, the notepad goes in the trash.
Total amnesia.
Right. The LLM's active context window wipes clean. When I boot the agent back up tomorrow morning, it forgets everything. It doesn't remember my project's coding conventions. It doesn't remember that I prefer PyTest over Unitest. Most crucially, it doesn't remember the 3 hours we spent debugging a cryptic memory leak yesterday.
It's like working with a goldfish.
Exactly. So how do we build a hard drive for a system that forgets everything the second the loop stops? That brings us to organ 5, memory, the patient record.
You might intuitively think that an advanced AI agent requires a wildly complex multidimensional vector database to store its long-term memories.
Yeah, you hear about vector databases all the time with AI.
Right, but the most effective, elegant systems often reject that complexity. They use something surprisingly simple, plain markdown files.
Wait, just regular text files? The exact same kind of formatting you use for a basic readme on GitHub?
Yes. Markdown files that a human being can easily read, easily manually edit, and easily check into version control alongside the source code.
That feels almost too simple.
But it works beautifully. These memory files can exist at different scopes to govern different behaviors. You might have a .agent memory folder in your project repository that contains the specific architectural rules for that code base. You might have global personal notes in your computer's home directory about your specific formatting preferences. You might even have shared team notes hosted on a server.
But there's a mechanical problem here. If I have a massive folder of markdown notes accumulated over 6 months, I can't just dump all 50 pages of text into the agent's context window at the start of a new session.
No, absolutely not.
First, I would burn through my token budget in about 3 seconds. Second, the model would be completely overwhelmed with irrelevant information about a database issue when I'm just asking it to fix a CSS button. How does it effectively retrieve the right memory?
This is where the architecture utilizes a technique called REG, or Retrieval Augmented Generation, but it applies it in a very lightweight, focused way. At the start of a session, before the main agent loop really gets going, the system does not read everything. Instead, it uses a very cheap, fast, secondary model call to simply skim the available notes.
A skim? Like it just speed reads them. How does that work in practice?
The system feeds the user's current goal and the summaries of all the available markdown files to this cheap model. It acts as a tiny dedicated librarian. It says, okay, the user wants to fix a front-end styling issue. I see a memory file about back-end database credentials. I will ignore that. I see a memory file about CSS conventions we established last week. I will pull that specific file.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, it acts as a retrieval system for its own notes to self, pulling only the highly specific context required for the immediate task. It keeps the context window lean, focused, and cheap.
It's like a surgeon preparing for an operation. They don't read the entire medical history of the patient's extended family. They just pull the specific chart regarding the patient's current heart condition and their drug allergies.
Exactly.
That is how it remembers. But how does it reflexively protect itself? A surgeon has reflexes to stop them from cutting an artery. How do we stop an agent from destroying our computer? This leads to organ 6, hooks. Dr. Agarwal calls these the spinal reflexes.
Hooks are user-defined tripwires embedded directly into the architecture. They act before the model's conscious thought even has a chance to execute.
Wait, how do they act before the model?
Because they are literal pieces of code that execute at fixed, immovable points in the agent's life cycle. For example, a hook can fire right before any tool runs or right after a tool finishes, or just as the entire loop is about to stop. They allow the human developer to intervene programmatically in the agent's operation.
I think we need to draw a massive distinction here between prompting and hooks, because when people first try to control AI, they try to do it with words.
They write massive, angry system prompts.
Yes. They write a very stern system prompt. You are a helpful assistant. You must never, under any circumstances, touch the production database configuration file. I am serious.
And the model just ignores it?
Right, because a prompt is really just a polite suggestion to a probability engine. The model might hallucinate. It might get confused by a highly complex task. It might convince itself that touching the database is necessary to fulfill the user's overarching goal, and it will simply ignore your stern instruction.
But a hook is not a suggestion.
Exactly. A hook is actual code, and code does not get creative. Code does not care about context or politeness. It enforces rules with absolute rigidity.
That distinction is the bedrock of agent security. You cannot rely on a stochastic engine to enforce its own security policies reliably.
So how does a hook physically intervene?
Well, a hook is not an LLM prompt. It could be a hard-coded shell script. It could be a web hook that pings an external enterprise security service for authorization. When the agent loop is about to execute a tool, the pre-execution hook fires. It physically inspects the proposed action and the exact inputs the model generated.
And then what?
That hook has the absolute power to block the action entirely, rewrite the inputs to make them safe, or forcefully halt the entire agent loop and throw an error.
Let's role play that. Yep. The model decides to fix this bug, I am going to delete the entire user database and start over. It generates the command drop table users.
A classic disaster.
Right. The agent loop says, okay, preparing to run the database tool. But right before it executes, the hook intercepts the request. The hook is just a 10-line Python script that says, if command contains drop, return block. The hook immediately rejects the action and returns a hard error to the loop.
Yes, and then the model sees the error in the transcript and has to figure out a different non-destructive way to solve the problem.
It converts safety from a prompting art, which is essentially just wishing for good behavior, into enforced deterministic policy. The reflexes protect the organism from its own potentially lethal decisions.
Precisely.
All right, so we have laid out all 6 organs on the operating table. We have the interface, which is the face, the toolbox, the motor system, subagents, the referral, state, the working memory, the patient record, and hooks, the spinal reflexes.
That's the full anatomy.
Now let's watch them beat in sequence. Let's look at anatomy in motion. I sit down at my terminal, I type add error handling to the login function, and I hit enter. What is the step-by-step reality of what happens inside the machine over the next 3 seconds? Dr. Agarwal breaks this down into a highly specific life cycle.
Let's walk through that timeline. Step 1 is housekeeping. Before the system even looks at your new prompt, the agent checks the state of the transcript. If you have been chatting and debugging for 2 hours, the transcript might be massive.
Like, it's huge.
Yeah, it might be nearing the token limit of the context window.
Yeah.
So the agent might silently run a background process to summarize older, resolved turns of the conversation, a process often called compaction, to save space and keep the model focused.
So the desk is swept clean. We are ready to work. Step 2, the model call.
The full, compacted transcript, along with your new prompt and the self-describing metadata of all the available tools, is sent over the network to the large language model. The LLM processes it, and the replies start streaming back to your interface token by token, word by word.
And this leads to step 3, which is where the engineering gets brilliant. Eager start. I want to spend significant time here because Dr. Agarwal calls this the speed trick most people never notice, and it involves a concept called speculative execution. How does the agent cheat time?
It is a fascinating optimization. As the model is streaming its text back over the network, maybe it's typing out the sentence, "I understand the goal. I will now open the login.py file to inspect the current functions." Mm. The agent architecture does not passively sit there waiting for the model to finish its thought.
It doesn't just wait.
No. Midstream, the system recognizes a tool request forming. It sees the specific syntax for open login.py. Because reading a file is a safe, non-mutative action, the agent starts executing that tool while the model is still streaming the rest of its sentence.
It overlaps the network stream with the local execution.
Yeah.
The analogy Dr. Agarwal uses from the medical field is perfect here. It's like an expert anesthetist in an operating room.
Yes.
They are watching the patient's vitals, and they anticipate a drop in blood pressure. They drop the likely drugs into the syringes before they are absolutely, totally certain they will need them. What is the cost of being wrong? If the patient stabilizes, you waste a few cents of medication in a plastic syringe.
But what is the cost of waiting?
Exactly. If you wait until the patient crashes to start frantically digging through drawers for the vial and drawing the drug, the delay is catastrophic.
Or, for a less stressful analogy, it is the bartender who sees a regular customer walk through the door and immediately starts pouring their usual pint before the customer even reaches the bar or opens their mouth.
That's a great one. But why do we engineer systems this way?
Because in computing, reading a file is computationally cheap. It costs almost nothing in CPU cycles. But latency forcing the human user to sit and stare at a loading spinner is a terrible user experience.
It's a calculated gamble. Very occasionally, the rest of the model's streaming output might somehow invalidate the initial request, and the agent just throws the preemptively read data in the trash. But 95% of the time, by the time the model finishes typing its sentence, the file contents are already retrieved, sitting in memory, and immediately ready for the next step.
It drastically speeds up the perceived intelligence and performance of the agent. Once the stream finally finishes, we move to step four, remaining actions.
What happens here?
The agent looks at any other tools the model requested in that turn. It runs any parallel safe actions simultaneously to save time, and it carefully runs any risky mutative actions, like editing a file one at a time. Each action passes through the validation checks, hits those spinal hooks we discussed, goes through user permission gates, and finally physically executes on the machine.
Which brings us to step five, feedback.
And here we must reiterate the concept of reentrancy. The results of all those actions, the text of the files, the success messages, or the massive red error stack traces, are simply appended to the bottom of the transcript as new system messages.
Just dumped at the bottom.
Exactly. There is no complex branching result handling phase written into the loop's code. The plumbing remains deliberately dumb. The intelligence about what those results actually mean is left entirely to the language model to figure out on its next pass.
Step six is the loop test. The agent simply asks the transcript, were more actions requested in the last turn? If yes, it loops all the way back to step two, feeding the newly updated transcript back to the model call. And finally, if no actions were requested, we hit step seven, finish.
Right, and the loop reports exactly why it ended. This entire cycle, steps two through six, might repeat autonomously 30 times for a single prompt you typed.
There's a deep fundamental architectural point to be made here about how this loop is actually constructed in the code base. The loop should be built as a generator.
Yes, a generator.
It is a producer that you, the interface, pull from, yielding new messages at the pace the UI can handle. It should not be built as a callback that aggressively pushes data at you asynchronously.
This is so important.
Let's translate that for someone who might not be deep into asynchronous programming. Why does it matter if we are pulling data from the loop versus the loop pushing data at us?
It matters immensely for the stability and debuggability of the system. If the loop is a generator you pull from, and your user interface falls behind, maybe your laptop is old and the UI is lagging, the generator just naturally pauses.
It just waits.
Yeah, it waits politely for the UI to catch up and ask for the next piece of data. If you panic and hit the escape key to cancel a dangerous operation, the UI simply stops pulling data, and the loop winds down cleanly and safely. And when it finishes, it returns a strongly typed reason for stopping. Aborted by user, hit token limit, halted by pre-execution hook.
And what's the alternative? The push method?
If you build a system on a messy tangle of callbacks, where processes are constantly pushing data, triggering other processes asynchronously, firing off events in the background, answering the simple question, Why did the agent stop working? Becomes an absolute nightmare.
You're just digging through spaghetti code.
You have to hunt through asynchronous logs to find which callback silently failed.
Mm.
As Dr. Agrawal notes in the masterclass, if you choose the programming language construct whose shape naturally matches the shape of your problem, half of your edge case bugs just evaporate.
It really emphasizes that the magic of AI isn't just the neural network, it's the invisible scaffolding holding it up.
Yep.
But let's transition to the dark side of this autonomy.
The dark side.
Yeah. We have built a beautifully efficient, recursive, eager starting machine. It is fast, it delegates to sub-agents, it loops relentlessly. But as Dr. Agrawal points out, this exact efficiency should make you sweat a little bit.
It really should.
We have literally handed over control of our physical computer to a stochastic text generator. It can edit files, it can reach out to the internet, it can rewrite your Git history. The gap between an incredibly useful colleague and an armor-HRF command that irreversibly deletes your entire hard drive is exactly one bad hallucinated tool call wide.
One bad guess from the model and your laptop is wiped.
Exactly. So how do we build an immune system for this thing? This takes us to section 6, the safety problem and permissions.
The answer that every mature agent architecture converges on is a rigid structural permission system.
Yeah.
It's absolutely not enough to just hope the model behaves or to try and prompt it into compliance. You need structural limits.
Mm.
And the first component of this immune system is the concept of modes or postures of trust.
Postures of trust. I like that.
You do not want to sprinkle ad hoc, is this allowed? If EF statements randomly throughout your code base. Instead, the agent resolves the safety of every single action through the single currently active mode.
Well, if we are handing over the keys to our computer, we can't just have a single on-off switch for autonomy. There has to be a spectrum of trust, right? Like a mode where it can look but not touch versus a mode where it just goes completely wild. Walk us through the spectrum.
At the most locked down, paranoid end of the spectrum, you have the read-only mode, sometimes called planning mode. In this posture, absolutely all mutative actions are hard blocked. The agent can read your files, it can analyze your code base, it can search the web, but it cannot change a single comma on your hard drive.
It's incredibly useful for when you just want the agent to propose an architectural plan without risking any damage.
Exactly. Moving one step up the trust scale, you have the default interactive mode. Here, the agent can plan and read freely, but every single risky action like editing a file, deleting a directory, or running a shell script requires your explicit manual click of an approve button before it executes.
And this is exactly where a lot of developers get deeply annoyed.
Oh, they hate it.
They download a new AI agent, they tell it to refactor a project, and then they have to sit there babysitting it, clicking approve 40 times in a row. They want the agent to just do the work.
Which is exactly why the next step exists. Auto accept edits mode. This is a very pragmatic middle ground. In this mode, routine file edits sail through automatically. The agent can rewrite code to its heart's content, but truly dangerous actions like executing a bash script or touching network configurations still pause and prompt you for approval.
That sounds reasonable, but if you want to push autonomy even further, there is auto mode. How does auto mode work without me clicking approve?
In auto mode, you replace the human approver with a second lightweight LLM.
Wait, another LLM?
Yes. This secondary reviewer model acts as a supervisor. It looks at each proposed action from the main agent, compares it against your original overarching prompt, and approves it if the action seems logically consistent and safe. It handles the babysitting for you.
Wow, an AI supervising an AI. That is wild. And then I assume the final mode at the end of the spectrum is just total chaos.
Unrestricted mode. No human prompts, no reviewer models, no safeguards. It just blindly executes whatever the main model decides to do.
That sounds terrifying.
It is. This mode should absolutely only ever be used in isolated disposable sandboxes or tightly controlled continuous integration environments where wiping the machine has zero consequences. You treat unrestricted mode like an unblinded clinical trial with experimental drugs, legitimate for research, but highly dangerous if unleashed in the wild on your personal laptop.
Okay, so we have these modes, but how does the agent actually make the decision in the heat of the millisecond? If a tool requests an action, who actually gets the final say? Dr. Agrawal calls this the resolution chain. It is a fixed, unyielding hierarchy of decision-making.
The order of this chain is paramount for security. When an action is proposed, who decides if it runs? First in line, always. The hooks.
The reflexes.
Right. As we discussed, these are hard user-defined rules. They fire before anything else. If a hook inspects the action and says block, that settles it. There is no appeal, no matter what mode you are in.
Boom. Blocked.
Yep. If the hooks allow it to pass, we move to the second stage. The tool's self-assessment. Remember, tools describe themselves. Each tool knows its own inherent risk level. A tool designed to simply read a file might flag itself as safe and wave itself through automatically. A tool designed to execute a shell command will inherently flag itself and say, "I am dangerous. I need to ask for permission."
And only then do we reach the third stage, the active mode.
Exactly. Only the ambiguous cases, the ones where the tool says ask, reach the mode level. The active mode then decides how that ask is handled. Does it pause and prompt the human? Does it ask the secondary LLM reviewer? Or, if you are in unrestricted mode, does it just allow it to execute and log it?
It is a brilliantly clear chain of command. Hooks, then tool, then mode. But I see a massive potential loophole here in the architecture.
A loophole?
Yeah. We talked earlier about subagents. Those child processes spawn to do delegated research or busy work. If I spawn a subagent to do a bunch of tedious refactoring, does it bypass this whole chain? Dr. Agarwal introduces the golden subagent rule here.
Yes, and this is a rule that engineers usually only discover they need after a catastrophic security incident. The golden subagent rule is this. Children cannot approve their own risky actions. They must always escalate upward.
I'm going to push back on that purely from a user experience perspective.
Go ahead.
If I spawn a subagent specifically to go do a bunch of tedious work so I don't have to look at it, why on earth would I want the child agent bugging me with permission prompts? Doesn't that completely defeat the entire purpose of delegating the autonomy in the first place?
It is incredibly frustrating for the user, yes. But consider the alternative. Imagine the security implications. Without mandatory upward escalation, delegation becomes a security laundering scheme.
A security laundering scheme? Walk me through exactly how that happens.
Imagine the main agent is deeply confused, or perhaps it has been compromised by a malicious instruction hidden in a file it just read. It wants to run a destructive command, like deleting a critical directory.
Okay, it wants to do something bad.
But it knows that you have the system set to default interactive mode, meaning it will have to ask you for permission, and you will obviously say no. If children could self-approve their actions, the compromised parent agent could simply spawn a child subagent, secretly hand the destructive command to the child, and let the child execute it silently in the background, completely bypassing your oversight.
Oh, wow. It uses the child as a proxy to bypass the human.
Exactly. By enforcing strict upward escalation, a child's request to perform a risky action gets routed back to the parent. If the parent doesn't have the authority to auto-approve it, the request routes all the way back up the chain to the ultimate authority. Autonomy must remain bounded, no matter how deep the recursion of subagents goes.
That is profound. It ensures the human is never structurally removed from the loop. And Dr. Agarwal has a very practical piece of advice for you, the listener, right here regarding these permission prompts. He says, when you first install a coding agent on your machine, your immediate temptation will be to switch off the annoying permission prompts so it can work faster.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. Run it in default heavily prompted mode for at least a week. Read every single prompt it surfaces. Why? Because by forcing yourself to review what the agent is actually trying to do behind the scenes, seeing its weird detours, its failed file reads, its strange logic, you build an accurate mental model of its behavior. You calibrate your expectations.
Trust is earned, not assumed. You have to watch the machine work, understand its failure modes, and see how it recovers before you take your hands completely off the steering wheel and trust it with your production files.
We are nearing the end of our anatomical tour. For you listening to this audio class, whether you are a data scientist looking to automate your pipelines, a clinician looking into health tech automation, or an engineer trying to build your own agentic tools from scratch, what are the overarching design rules to steal from this masterclass? Section 7 is all about architecture best practices. Let's start with this concept of one model, many doorways.
This is a crucial architectural detail for anyone building these systems for real-world enterprise use. When you build the core engine of an agent, you should never hard code exactly how the agent reaches the large language model. The system should not care if it is talking directly to OpenAI's public API, or if it is routing through a secure, enterprise-governed Azure endpoint, or even if it is talking to a local open source model running on your own physical hardware.
I imagine this is because enterprise data governance is a total nightmare.
Oh, it's the worst.
You might build a brilliant prototype using a direct public API on your laptop, but the moment you try to deploy that prototype in a hospital setting or a bank, the security team will absolutely demand that all data flows through their heavily monitored internal cloud infrastructure.
Exactly. And if you hard code the API calls throughout your agent loop, you will have to rewrite the entire system to deploy it. Well-architected agents hide this connection behind what software engineers call a single factory pattern.
Let's unpack factory pattern for the non-engineers. What does that actually mean?
Think of it as a single central toll booth. At startup, a simple configuration file tells the toll booth where to route the traffic today. The agent loop just sends its transcript to the toll booth. The toll booth handles the specific formatting and routing to whatever model is active, gets the response, and hands it back to the loop in a standardized format.
So the loop is totally blind to where the model actually lives.
Completely blind. Nothing else in the massive agent architecture, none of the tools, none of the sub-agents, none of the hooks, ever knows the difference. The system is entirely provider agnostic. Switching from a public API to an enterprise proxy should require changing exactly one line of text in a config file, not performing deep invasive surgery on the code base.
It's about designing the seams of the software correctly from day one. Let's quickly recap the other stealable rules we've covered today, just to cement them in the syllabus. Rule one, make the loop the only loop. Don't build leap variants for sub-agents or different entry points. That just breeds inconsistencies and security holes.
Rule two, let tools describe themselves. Attach the schema, the metadata, and the permissions to the tool package itself, not centralized in the loop. Your future self will thank you when you add the 50th tool.
Rule three, split calm state from busy state. Put static session data in a plain, cheap object and rapidly changing UI data in a reactive store to prevent your CPU from melting.
Rule four, name your trust levels. Use explicit, overarching permission modes rather than scattered if allowed checks hidden in the code. When something breaks at 2 a.m., you want to know exactly what security posture was active.
Rule five, escalate, don't self-approve. Delegated sub-agents must pass dangerous decisions up the chain of command to prevent security laundering.
And rule six, prefer plain, human-readable markdown files over complex vector databases for memory. They are easily editable, version-controllable, and perfect for lightweight RAG retrieval.
Those rules do not require a massive enterprise research budget to implement. They are not theoretical. They are simply the result of rigorous, practical engineering discovered through the painful trial and error of making autonomous agents actually work reliably for real people in unpredictable environments.
When you compose a system utilizing these structural rules, the final product feels far more capable, far more resilient, and seemingly far more intelligent than any of its individual simple parts would suggest.
We've traveled quite a distance up the stack today. We've completely stripped away the magic. When you watch an AI agent quietly read files, run tests, and fix bugs on its own tomorrow, you now know that it isn't a ghost with free will.
You know exactly which of the six organs just fired.
You see the thin interface passing the request. You see the agent loop appending the transcript and feeding it to the model. You see the eager start speculatively reaching into the toolbox to save latency. You see the state splitting between the desk and the notepad, the markdown memory being skimmed for context, and the hook standing guard to prevent disaster.
It is all just beautifully orchestrated, highly deterministic engineering wrapped around a text predictor.
It really is. And as Dr. Agarwal notes in his masterclass, having explored the bottom of the stack with the basic math of neural networks and the top of the stack today with this agent architecture, the next frontier to tackle is the middle, the transformer itself. How the language model actually turns that massive appended transcript into the probability of the next token.
That will be a deep dive for another day.
Definitely. But before we wrap up this class, I want to leave you, the listener, with a provocative thought to mull over. We've spent this entire time talking about the surrounding architecture, the reentrant loop, the markdown memory files, the self-describing toolbox, the spinal hooks. We established that the LLM itself doesn't do anything. It is just the engine sitting in the middle of this complex organism.
A completely replaceable engine, in many ways.
Exactly. So here is the philosophical engineering question. If an AI agent's behavior, its safety rails, its long-term memory, and its physical ability to act in the world are truly defined by the surrounding architecture, at what point does the organism outgrow the brain? Think about it.
It's a trippy thought.
Right. Could you pause an agent right in the middle of a complex multi-day coding task, completely hot swap the underlying LLM, say, rip out a Claude model and drop in an OpenAI model, and have the agent retain its exact identity, its workflow, and its context through its markdown memory and its active sub-agents?
It is a profound question. Is the true intelligence of an autonomous system actually found in the structure of the loop and the resilience of the tools, rather than just the raw predictive power of the model itself?
If the brain is utterly interchangeable, where does the agent's identity actually reside? Something for you to think about next time you see that terminal window start moving on its own. Thank you so much for attending today's audio class. Keep questioning the magic, keep looking for the engineering underneath, and keep exploring. Until next time.